I've been asked to talk in this last session today really about my role or my work in the Historical Association Suffrage Resources Project, which some of you may or may not have seen. There's a website dedicated to that, and you can see the web address there at the bottom. And specifically, although I did do other things for the project, what I've been asked to talk about is the central role that I performed really, which was to create, to research, to draw together resources on a database, a suffrage database for the project, around which pretty much everything else on the website is built. Now, the database itself is really made up from two key sources, one being the 1866 female suffrage petition to Parliament, which was signed by just under 1,500 women from across the country. And the other resource, right at the sort of other end and the other extreme of the Votes for Women campaign, is the Home Office records of suffragettes arrested. And that spans the period really between 1906 and 1914. So what I'm going to do, I think, is try and be a little bit structured about this, because I'm going to try and fit quite a lot in, but at the same time I'm going to try and be a bit thematic about it. So firstly, I'm going to talk in both parts, well, in two parts. In both of them, I'm going to give a little bit of a potted history, just really to provide a context so that I can then talk about the two documents that form the essence of the database. And then once I've talked a little bit about the documents themselves, I'll then be moving on to really look at a couple of interesting characters, I think, that have sort of stood out to me in that research process for quite different reasons, but also that are fairly hidden from what we think of as popular suffrage histories. And I think the sort of stories that really need to be told, and that we hope the Suffrage Resources Project will help you, as I'm assuming most of you are teachers, to be able to tell. So first of all, a very potted history. The path to women's suffrage was a long and very complicated one, hence I'm going to briefly start in 1832, when other than a small male sort of aristocratic political elite, very few people had parliamentary representation. Ordinary men and women were certainly not included. However, the 1832 Great Reform Act was passed, and although its extension of the franchise was very limited, it nevertheless represents for many the beginning of Britain's journey towards true democracy, sowing the seeds, if you like, of electoral change. And yet, of course, women were excluded under the terms of the Act. Before the Great Reform Act, sort of historical and legislative debates, if you like, had been framed using the generic term persons. What the Great Reform Act did was substitute that generic term persons with the term male persons. So in this sense, the principle, if you like, for women's enfranchisement existed before the Great Reform Act. Afterwards, it really didn't. So the Great Reform Act, in a sense, really removed the possibility for women of gaining future enfranchisement. Now, this was an injustice that was recognised not least by Mary Smith, and a married woman in Yorkshire, who, through her local MP, Henry Hunt, sent a petition to Parliament stating that she paid taxes and therefore did not see why she should not have a share in the election of a representative. Women were liable to all punishments of the law, not excepting death, and ought to have a voice in making them. Now, Mary's represented in this sense the first petition to Parliament for female suffrage, but by no means, of course, the last. And women would continue to argue for the vote, using really the fundamental principles put forward by Mary, until they were granted the vote on the same terms as men, almost 100 years. And I still can't believe it when I say that later in 1928. I still find it hard to believe. Now, in the years that immediately followed the Great Reform Act, women actually mounted numerous legal challenges to it on the basis of that substitution of the term persons with the term male persons. But of course, they lost. Not because, of course, any of the legal or historical arguments that they were using to argue against that term were in any way flawed, but simply because judges ruled on the basis of gender that women were simply incapable of voting. However, throughout these years, women's shared struggles saw them establish stronger networks, becoming better organised, so much so that by 1865 they had set about organising a landmark petition to Parliament for female suffrage, to be submitted the following year by Liberal MP and stalwart supporter of female suffrage, John Stuart Mill. Now, by today's standards, and even perhaps some of the latest standards of the women's suffrage campaign, the 1866 petition might actually seem to be quite relatively small. As I say, it was only signed really by just under 1,500 women. But it drew upon signatures from women all over the country and from different backgrounds. And as true pioneers of women's political rights, I think its signatories really simply had to be included in the Historical Association's suffrage resources database. So, sadly, the original petition no longer exists. But fortunately, one of its organisers, who you can see there, Emily Davis, who was a pioneer of women's education and actually one of the founders, in a sense, of Girton College, was one of the women also who presented the petition to John Stuart Mill on the parliamentary steps, had the foresight to get sort of several printed copies, not just made, but also published and circulated to publicise this petition. And I wasn't so surprised by this when, you know, you really think that Emily Davis was really in the teaching profession and she was bound to be organised and bound to be the sort of person that produced lots of copies just in case. Now, the petition itself, I mean, you can sort of see a few names, hopefully, just at the bottom there. Features each woman's name, often, though not always, the location where women sign the petition, and on occasion their occupation, but really very little else. And within these fields, there are many variables. So, for instance, as you can see on some of the few examples at the bottom there, some women gave their full names for the petition, which, of course, makes it easier for us as historians to try and track them down. Other women, perhaps less helpfully, just recorded themselves as Mrs. Smith. So you can imagine that that causes lots of problems. For some, a very specific address is recorded, for there you can see Kate Ackland, 14 Buckingham Street, Strand, London. Very specific. For others, they simply wrote down the town or the county, or in many cases, actually nothing at all. The database, of course, can be searched in lots of different ways. You can search it using towns, you can search it using counties, for example. But obviously these types of vagaries do make it difficult to trace the lives of many of the women from the 1866 petition. But what we can see from the petition, and obviously therefore from the database that we've recorded them on, is that female suffrage was actually far more diverse than was often assumed or portrayed many, many years ago in suffrage histories. For example, there's evidence of working class women such as charwoman Emma Tingle, who signed the 1866 suffrage petition in Leeds. There was printer's wife, Susanna G., who was responsible for collecting as many signatures as she could from her neighbours and friends in Denby in Wales. And she also had Labour movement connections too. And then, of course, we have women of colour, like Sarah Parker Ramond. Now, she's quite a well-known anti-slavery campaigner. And she actually signed the 1866 petition when she was touring the country, talking about that very topic. So I think what the 1866 petition shows, and why it's so useful really, is that the suffrage movement in 1866 did not just contain the general stereotype of suffrage campaigners in this era, which tends to be staid, white, middle-class women. There was diversity, although, of course, that diversity becomes much more apparent or more visible in the 20th century, and we'll return to that subject later in part two when we come back to the suffragettes' recorded index. So, ironically, what I'm actually going to do is focus on that stereotype. So I'm actually going to focus on two staid white middle class, indeed, as well as an upper class 19th century campaigner who signed the 1866 petition. But what I hope to show in reality is actually these unseemly women didn't actually fit that stereotype at all. And for that reason, have really been effectively for many years written out of suffrage histories and actually out of the wider women's movement histories too. So first of all, I'm going to talk about this lady who you may or may not be familiar with, Elizabeth Wolstenholme Elmy. Now, she was born in Manchester, and she was the daughter of a Methodist minister, although she was actually orphaned when she was quite young. She left school aged 16, and after working as a governess, which of course was an acceptable profession for a slightly impoverished middle-class woman in this era, she opened her own boarding school for girls with a fund left from her parents' death. Now, the improvement of women and girls' education, which I'm sure will resonate with many of you here, which was, of course, woefully inadequate in that era, would become a lifelong passion for Elizabeth, alongside campaigning for the women's suffrage movement and other female-centred reforms. For instance, in 1865, through work at her own school, Elizabeth founded the Manchester Schoolmistresses Association, which spread across the North, and 2 years later, the North of England Council for promoting the education of women. The council was important because it pushed for improvements in the education of women and girls, including their ability to take university examinations. And in 1866, the same year that she signed the women's suffrage petition, Elizabeth was given the important task of giving evidence to the very first Royal Commission set up to look at secondary education. Now, Elizabeth was living in Manchester when she actually signed the 1866 petition, but was nevertheless a member of the influential feminist Kensington Society that was based in London, and was really responsible for organising and executing the petition. Elizabeth was in fact responsible for collecting about 300 of its signatures from women in the North, which is quite a large number when you think that the total signatories were 1,500, or just under 1,500. And Elizabeth's strong sense of justice meant she inevitably played an active role in the unfolding women's suffrage movement in the years that followed. For instance, she was likely behind, but is seldom credited with, the formation of the Manchester National Society for Women's Suffrage, which was part of a larger central committee. And clearly possessed with the courage of her own convictions when she disagreed with its decision not to lift the exclusion of married women from its suffrage reform proposals, she set up a new society, the Women's Franchise League, along with other Manchester radicals, including the future WSPU leader, Emmeline Pankhurst. In the 1890s, she set up another society, the Women's Emancipation Union, which had a mandate to work for women's equality in politics and in all other areas of life. And such was her commitment to it that she and her then husband, Ben Elmy, had to borrow money against their home just to keep it going. And the union's agitation was actually central to married women gaining the right to vote in local elections in 1894. Now, during these years, Elizabeth fought hard for women's rights, especially within marriage, which she saw in its current form, and I quote, as a lifelong sentence of pauperism and dependence. In marriage, a husband, of course, had all rights over his wife's property and person. So, for instance, if a wife refused sex with her husband, he could lawfully imprison her against her will until these rights had been restored, and I think we all know the implications of what that means. Through her dogged work as a member of the Married Women Property Committee, Elizabeth was at the heart of passing the Married Women's Property Acts in 1870 and 1882. And although these by no means achieved equality for women in marriage, they did help to redress some of those balances and certainly pave the way for future reform. And ironically, it was sexual scandal surrounding Elizabeth's own private life and marriage that for many years saw her written really out of the histories of the women's suffrage movement and indeed of the wider women's suffrage campaign. Elizabeth was a secularist and entered a free union with Ben Elmy, meaning that they lived initially as man and wife but without being married. Now, at this time, this aspect of her lifestyle alone was socially scandalous, and matters were made worse when Elizabeth became pregnant. Now, many of those working alongside her in the women's suffrage movement were actually quite angry with Elizabeth because they thought that her lifestyle could effectively bring a bad name. It could besmirch the reputation of the women's suffrage movement, which had to hold itself to a very high moral standard. And so they saw this lifestyle as not being acceptable. It wasn't respectable. It was unseemly. So they effectively really sort of pressured her, I guess, peer pressure, to marry, and she reluctantly did so in 1874. And I say reluctantly, I don't mean that as any sort of sort of reflection on her husband. I think it was just something that obviously, you know, she had very strong feelings about. Sadly, however, this sort of scandal has followed Elizabeth through time, and it's only really through recent changes in attitudes that she's really started to regain that place that she truly deserves in histories of the women's suffrage movement and in actually wider women's movement histories as not only a radical political figure, but also a radical social pioneer. And one of the things I love about Elizabeth is that she remained willing to change and challenge the status quo and followed sort of that instinct to change right up until the very last. Despite living through the 19th century suffrage campaign, which of course was framed by this law-abiding constitutional approach to fighting for votes for women, Elizabeth was nonetheless excited by the more radical suffrage activity emerging in the 20th century and in the north of England, encapsulated by the formation of the WSPU in 1903. And she supported it from its earliest days. She took part in WSPU processions and appeared in photographs and interviews to help them to promote the union and with propaganda. And she was often described by the WSPU as the oldest militant suffragette or sometimes suffragist. And you can see there's a picture here of Elizabeth in the centre there, and she's leaning over a balcony, and you can see the banner underneath, England's oldest militant suffragist greets her sisters. And this was actually taken at the women's coronation procession in London in 1911, which was a huge coronation procession that went all through the streets of London, and at some points was sort of 7 miles long, it was so huge. And Elizabeth was right there at the heart of it all. Now, she continued to publicly support the WSPU until about 1912, when she seems to have left the committee, probably because of the increase in suffragette militancy at that time. And I think in the end, she sort of came full circle and realised that the only way to get the vote really was to keep applying and keep using those law-abiding methods of pressure. But that was not the end of Elizabeth's suffrage story. In 1913, by then aged 80, I love it, she became vice president of the Women's Tax Resistance League, and that same year played a role in the National Union of Women's Suffrage Society's Great Pilgrimage. And the pilgrimage saw women walk from sort of all corners of the country down to a rally point in London. And Elizabeth led some of those pilgrims on their leg of the journey into Congleton. Now, Elizabeth died in 1918, just 6 days after the Representation of the People Act, which partially granted votes for women, was given royal assent. And I think it's really fitting that Elizabeth lived long enough to see at least her dream partially realised, let's put it that way. So I just want to reflect on that picture that we began with of Elizabeth. In this snapshot of Elizabeth, who do we see? A staid, white, middle-class Victorian campaigner, that stereotype who quietly signed the 1866 suffrage petition? Or do we see what we should see, which is actually a political pioneer and a social radical who was way ahead of her time, who embraced change and broke the rules, both in her private and in her public life, and is now getting the recognition that she really and truly deserves? So my next unseemly woman for the stereotype is moving up the social class rather to Viscountess Catherine Amberley. Now she was another lady that signed the 1866 suffrage petition and is therefore in the Historical Association database, and she was born in Cheshire in 1842. Now, Catherine was a very lively and outspoken member of the political Stanley family, and although subject to the inadequate homeschooling that women of her class were subjected to in this era, she sort of educated herself assiduously. And I absolutely love this photo here on the right-hand side. I think she's really sort of turning that education on her dogs by the looks of it. It's just such a wonderful photograph of her, obviously. I don't know whether she's training them or telling them off, but either way, it's a wonderful photograph. She... became, after marrying Viscount Amberley, who you can see there on the left-hand side, in 1864, a really outspoken advocate of female suffrage. As I said, she signed the 1866 suffrage petition, but she also became the first president of the Bristol and West of England branch of the National Society for Women's Suffrage in 1868 and of its Monmouthshire Committee in 1872. Now, Catherine really stands out in many ways because she so very publicly supported the women's suffrage campaign in this era, which challenged the social and cultural conventions of her class and gender. Engaging in political causes, of course, political causes being the man's sphere, was really considered unseemly, especially for a woman of such high social status. And I might also mention here, although I do so with a cautionary note, that there is some suggestion that as happy as she and her husband seem to have been in their marriage, that Catherine allowed their son's tutor, who suffered from consumption, and therefore who she and the Viscount saw as being unfairly condemned to a life of celibacy, she actually allowed him to move in with her, to live with her. Now, we can't say whether this was really a sexual relationship. We can really only speculate on this because many of Catherine and her husband's letters and diaries were destroyed by his family upon his death very rapidly in 1876. So that can only be speculative. But either way, him even living with her was certainly what we would call unseemly at that time. Now, undeterred by taking up the suffrage cause in public and that risk to her reputation that went with it, in 1870, Catherine gave a public lecture in Stroud, which was later published as an article, The Claims of Women, which drew the wrath of many of her aristocratic peers, including Queen Victoria, who, of course, was opposed to women's suffrage. Speaking in public, as Catherine did, was an absolute social no-no for someone of her class and status, and Queen Victoria personally urged everyone that knew her, that knew Catherine, to advise her against this wicked folly of women's rights, adding in a rather ranting letter that Lady Amberley ought to get a good whipping. However, Catherine herself remained defiant. She continued her support for female suffrage and was also integrally involved with the Married Women's Property Committee, which I mentioned earlier in relation to Elizabeth Wolstenholme Elmy, really strove for women's equality in marriage. She also campaigned for women's equal education, providing a scholarship fund to train women doctors, and retained Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, of course, the first woman to qualify as a doctor, as her personal physician. Catherine also supported and argued for, in her published article, The Claims of Women, for women's equal pay, and also that they should have full access to all professions. So she really was ahead of her time in this thinking. Sadly, Catherine's work for women's rights was cut short by her untimely death in 1874, aged just 32 years old. She died of diphtheria, which she caught while nursing her daughter, who also sadly died too. So far from the quiet campaigners that we often stereotype of 19th century era and women's suffrage campaigners in that era, I think these two really defy that sort of gender and class status that we so often assume is the case. Both broke that stereotype of what we imagine white middle-class Victorians to be, and many women who signed the 1866 petition also did so. So in the next part, we're going to move on to the 20th century. But first, a little bit more of that potted history. Despite the incredible efforts of pioneering women who organised and signed the 1866 petition, like Elizabeth and Catherine, the following year in 1867, a further Reform Act was passed that enfranchised more men. But women's efforts had at least seen their political self-confidence grow. And so we see that year also a flurry of women's suffrage societies forming and formalising for the first time, notably the Manchester National Society for Women's Suffrage. But this was quickly followed by similar societies in many of the major cities such as London, Birmingham and Edinburgh. And in turn, these were swiftly followed by lots of others, and there are far, far too many of them for me to go into detail about here. But again, there is a resource about that actually on the Historical Association's resources website. But many of these sort of mushrooming organisations, sorry, I meant to move that slide forward, were very short-lived because women were really still finding their political feet as suffrage societies, still deciding on tactics and ideologies. For example, should they pursue a purely political agenda, just campaigning for the women's right to vote? Or whether alongside they should also campaign to promote wider social reforms that benefited women in things like education, marriage and employment. Hence, this was a tumultuous time in the histories of women's suffrage, but suffice to say that when a further Reform Act was passed in 1884 that enfranchised yet more men, women really started to pull together. And after much discussion and deliberation, a national federated or umbrella society was formed in 1897, and that, of course, was the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. Now, the National Union, of course, was led from 1907 by Mrs. Millicent Fawcett, whose statue has only, of course, recently been erected in Parliament Square. And it would go on to be the largest suffrage society and establish a network of supporters in literally every village, town and city across the country. It used, of course, as I'm sure you know, traditional constitutional law-abiding methods of campaigning that its forebear societies had used, patiently and diligently organising suffrage meetings, petitions, educating the public and lobbying MPs, using what we might call, I guess, a politics of persuasion. And the National Union had every reason to believe that, although it had so far been a very painful and slow process, women's full rights to parliamentary voting may not be too far away, because some gains had been made. In the late 19th century, single or widowed local taxpaying women had got the right to vote for county councillors, for example. Married women who were household occupiers had been able to vote in local elections. And more recently, in the early 20th century, women local taxpayers had won the right to vote in local elections and participate in all aspects of local government. So things must have really seemed at that point within touching distance. But in the interim, of course, some more radical women in the industrial north were understandably impatient that women had still not achieved enfranchisement after over half a century of campaigning. And they remained completely unconvinced that these quiet traditional methods of persuasion alone would see male politicians really do the right thing. And so they decided to try some different tactics and more radical tactics alongside. Thus it was that in Manchester in 1903, Mrs. Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughters, together with several other women, founded and formed the nucleus of the new society, the Women's Social and Political Union. And the WSP's motto, of course, was deeds, not words, and their range of deeds, which are commonly referred to, obviously, as militant tactics, started with the heckling of politicians and government ministers at public meetings, and escalated, as I'm sure you know, to property damage, arson, bombings, and eventually the death of WSP activist Emily Wilding Davidson under the King's Horse at Epsom Derby in 1913. Now, the tactics used by suffragette of course, have caused enduring fascination because they were radical by any standards. But for women, these actions also broke the mould of Edwardian femininity and the expectations of what women could and couldn't, or certainly should and shouldn't do. But the WSPU, of course, were not the only suffragettes. In 1907, a breakaway group formed from the WSPU, taking just under a quarter of its members with them. And this group, headed by Charlotte Despard, was named the Women's Freedom League, and its founders generally disliked the sort of autocratic rather than democratic approach that was increasingly being taken by the Pankhursts to the WSPU, as well as what some League members saw as the WSPU's loosening of ties to its roots with the working class labour movement. Now, the League was the next largest suffrage society to the National Union and the WSPU, and its members, too, were willing to break the law. However, overall, the League preferred sort of tactics of civil disobedience, more strategic and less violent methods of protest, though they weren't averse, of course, to breaking the odd window or setting fire to the odd pillar box or two. Now, given the League's considerable size, it's actually really underrepresented overall within the histories of the women's suffrage movement. I think one good thing about the Suffrage Resources Project, and because of using the suffragettes arrested index as a sort of central document for its database, we actually do see the Women's Freedom League quite well represented in the database. And I think that's a really good thing, because historians really now are looking to push the Women's Freedom League forward and to get more or their sort of better recognition for them in the histories of the campaign. So that brings me to, we've talked about the 1866 petition, but now that brings me to the other sort of central record that forms the Historical Association's database, which is the record produced by the Home Office of Suffragettes Arrested. And you can see the front cover of the book just there on the left. So, of course, whether you belong to the WSPU or the Women's Freedom League, if you were willing to break the law, it meant that you were essentially willing to be arrested. And, of course, there were always government officials willing to diligently record such things, and they do so on a number of documents, and this is one of them. So, of course, it records suffragettes arrested between that period, 1906 and 1914. So just to quickly say a few words about really some of the complexities of this fascinating document, which is held at the National Archives in Kew. The index is believed by archivists there to have been actually copied out by government clerks from another card index. For what reason? They don't really know. So that is interesting in itself. The index generally records suffragette names in alphabetical order, along with when they were arrested and the name of the station they were taken to and charged. So here, for example, you can see Patricia Woodlock, a Liverpudlian suffragette, an artist. This is her arrest record. So you can see she's recorded as being arrested 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. She's recorded as arrested in Westminster, Bow Street, once in Birmingham, but obviously predominantly in London. So for the database, for the Historical Association, these names were transcribed, and also these entries that you can see listed there were also added together. So we could come up with a total number of times that each suffragette was arrested to simplify that data, obviously for use in schools for teaching purposes. Now that sounds quite straightforward, right? Just adding these things together and coming up with a total number of suffragettes arrested. But of course, as always with these documents, there are several anomalies. Now, I can't talk about all of them because I just simply don't have the time. But just to give you for instance, if you like, there are several instances where suffragette names are recorded out of the general alphabetical order. And also they appear sort of in sort of random places within the index where they really shouldn't be. So that raises the question, we know this was hand-copied out from another index. Was it human error? Were these accidental duplications? These are kind of questions that could actually affect our overall understanding of the total number of times these women were arrested, but we can't always find definitive answers. And then, of course, there are suffragette aliases, which you may be aware of, and these were the sort of fictitious names that suffragettes sometimes used to confuse or evade the authorities. Now, suffragette aliases were a challenge contemporaneously for the police and for record keepers at the time, and of course, no less so for historians many years later. Now, the police knew of several suffragette aliases, and at the time, these were noted in the arrest index. And as a for instance, this is the rather beautiful Lillian Lenton, suffragette and prolific arsonist and vandal, who was very often on the run from the authorities. And here we can see that she's been recorded under her real name, Lenton Lillian, but also they've recorded her known aliases. So we have Ida Inkley, although I have to say I've also come across some reports where she's been referred to as Ada Inkley recently. You can also see she was recorded as May Dennis. That was another one of her aliases. And you can see each time she's been arrested, and also I think you can see how mobile she is as well, looking at the different places she's arrested. But you can also see there she was arrested as Inkley. In Richmond, she was arrested in her own name, Lenton. In Doncaster, as Dennis. So, you know, this just kind of shows the sort of trickery, if you like, of some suffragettes, which I think is a sort of marvellous record in itself. And for that reason, we didn't really want to touch that for the database. So we've left, although we are aware of some of these aliases, we've actually left them as they are in the database, as they're recorded in the index. And we've produced a guide to go with that. So hopefully pupils and teachers can kind of explore those aliases and try and understand, perhaps even add together some of those times to get an accurate picture of how many times these women were arrested. So what does this fascinating document reveal about who was arrested? And what does additional research tell us about why they were arrested and what motivated them? What we do know in the 20th century is that we have much more visibility of suffrage campaigners, so we see much more diversity. So what I want to explore, and I think what the database does by recording suffragettes arrested, is to give glimpses into the lives of that diversity, rather than just relying on representations of leaders, such as the Pankhursts, for example, or well-known martyrs, such as Emily Wilding Davison. So just as a quick for instance, there are so many fascinating stories. I mean, just trying to choose a couple for today was an absolute nightmare because I just love them all. Just as a little for instance, here we have some of the, I suppose, representations of diversity that we find in the Suffragette Arrested Index. So we have people in there like Princess Sophia Duleep Singh, who you may have heard of. So she was an Indian princess and goddaughter to Queen Victoria, who took up the suffrage cause with the WSPU from her royally granted apartment in Hampton Court Palace. So I'm sure you can imagine the sort of level of embarrassment that this caused the establishment. Also, we have diverse lives in terms of sexualities. So here we have campaigner Vera Jack Holmes, who was a cross-dressing actress and lesbian and WSPU chauffeur to the Pankhursts, but who also worked to help Serbian refugees with her partner and fellow suffragettes during the First World War. On all of these, these case studies are on the Historical Association Suffrage Resources website, and there are many more to come, so do keep logging on and do keep looking out for them. For me personally today, I know we don't have much time and everyone's very tired, so I'm going to focus on two of my heroes, and they're working class heroes, and that's suffragette Adelaide Knight and suffragette hunger striker William Ball, because the stories of their extraordinary yet ordinary lives are stories about cooperation and companionship between women and men in this fight, about hardship, about motivation, and about what compelled people to take part in the Votes for Women cause and the cause for greater equality. So, let me start by saying that Adelaide had a very tough start to life. She was born into a poverty-stricken community in Bethnal Green in the East End of London. There's not much mention of her mother in her early life, but we certainly know a little bit about her father. He was a hairdresser and he was also an alcoholic, and he committed suicide when Adelaide was quite young. Now, Adelaide was also severely crippled as a child, and she used walking sticks for the rest of her life. Now, I'm sure this almost sounds like the beginning of a tragic story of really Dickensian-type proportions. But Adelaide possessed an irrepressible spirit, a strength and intelligence that saw her contribute to the Votes for Women campaign and to work tirelessly to improve the lives of all working women and men through socialist politics and to tackle with her husband other cultural prejudices. Now, Adelaide loved poetry and music and read widely to educate herself. And in 1894, she married Donald Adolphus Brown, the son of a naval officer from Guana. And their mixed race marriage, highly unusual for that time, meant facing down racial prejudices. And their equitable marriage also defied other cultural boundaries of the day too. So for example, and I think you can, it's hard to make out because the photograph's so grainy, but she is actually using a stick there. She's actually leaning on it on that left-hand side of the photograph. But Adelaide's hips often pained her. And so the two shared the domestic chores, including doing the laundry, the weekly laundry. And Donald was also happy to take Adelaide's surname, being known locally as Donald Knight. Now, the two also shared a desire to change the poverty-stricken world that they lived in, joining the Independent Labour Party. And in 1906, Adelaide also joined the Women's Social and Political Union. And she was actually a member and secretary of the Canning Town branch of the union. Now, in 1906, she was arrested with others for taking part in a deputation to Herbert Asquith's house in Cavendish Square and was charged with disturbing the peace. She was to be imprisoned in Holloway for 6 weeks unless she agreed to take no further part in the Votes for Women campaign. Now, this was an incredibly weighty dilemma for Adelaide. By then, she and Donald had 2 children, the youngest being just 18 months old, and her health was never good. Now, their daughter, in her biography in later years, recalled a conversation that the couple had had about this dilemma in front of her. And Adelaide said to Donald, "To draw back from this will encourage intimidation. Can I count on you for your full support? It will be agonising to be away from you and our children, but with your help, I can face this." And Donald replied, "We have supported each other for many years. We must not fail now that we are put to the test." And so Adelaide chose to go to prison, writing, "I refuse to barter my freedom to act according to my conscience while my health permits me to fight on." Donald was fully supportive and looked after their children while she was in prison. Now, prison conditions, as I'm sure you're aware, were harsh, and Adelaide's health suffered, but she remained defiant, and she sang the socialist anthem, "The Red Flag," every morning without fail, and she scratched its lyrics into the windowsill of her cell with one of those horrendous Edwardian hairpins, so she really put it to good use there. But Adelaide was representative of many working class women in her area of London at this time who had really started to grow a little bit suspicious about the lack of democracy within the WSPU and its motives in using working women as and when it seemed to suit them. And she really had quite a dilemma and a crisis over this and about what to do about it. Now, as I think I mentioned earlier, this had been the motivation of some of the women who had decided to sort of cross over and move to the Women's Freedom League, leaving the WSPU. But Adelaide just seems to have lost trust in middle-class women suffragists and suffrage societies altogether, and she effectively stepped away from the Votes for Women campaign in 1907, resigning from the WSPU. But instead, she decided to focus on campaigning for working-class women's issues, becoming secretary of the Canning Town branch, but this time for adult suffrage, which worked for Votes for Women alongside the needs of working men, many of whom, who of course, were also without the vote at this time. Together with Donald, she joined the Social Democratic Federation, which was a socialist group alongside the Labour Party, and she also served on the West Ham Board of Guardians, of course, where she was responsible for sort of looking out and looking after how funds were distributed, for example, to take care of the poor. And in 1920, she became a founding member of the Communist Party of Great Britain. So when we look at Adelaide's beginnings and where she came from, I mean, that in itself was such a struggle. And the struggle must have carried on for her and Donald in daily life. And the fact that the two of them were so committed to changing the community around them and to try and improve the lives of those around them who lived in that same community and lived the same life, I think is so inspiring. And I'm full of admiration for them. I hope that you are too. Now, my final working class hero, and I hope not too controversially, is a man. And that's William Ball. Now, he was twice arrested for the suffrage cause, which is why he appears in the Home Office Index. And we know relatively little with any certainty about William, and yet for me, it's that ordinariness that makes his story all the more compelling, and his motivation certainly no less important. And he also represents that sort of growing visibility of men in the movement in the 20th century. So what can we say about William? Well, we know he was from the West Midlands, most likely from Staffordshire, probably spent some time in Birmingham before moving to London. He was a member of the National Transport Workers Federation and had been an athlete at some point, running for a Midlands Federation for several years. Obviously, at some point, he seems to have fallen on hard times. We know that throughout much of the Votes for Women campaign, he worked as a labourer, and obviously, you know, the financial rewards for that weren't great. We also know that he was married to his wife, Jessie, and we know that they had five children together. Now, one of the things that immediately struck me about William was not only his support for the women's suffrage campaign, but also his motivations for that support. Because this is something that we're not always privy to when it comes to rare instances, really, of finding working class men that were active in supporting the female suffrage cause. Now, William believed in adult suffrage, as many working class men, as I mentioned, hadn't got the vote either at this time. But he also believed that women should be enfranchised in line with men before more men were enfranchised. And as we'll see shortly, he was actually arrested and brutally treated in prison for supporting the suffragette cause. And it's his court appearances in relation to that that really reveal to us his motivation for supporting the campaign. When asked why he supported the suffragette cause, he simply said that his family was made up of both daughters and sons, and he wanted as much protection for his girls as he did for his boys. Now, William was sent to prison for breaking two windows at the Home Office in 1911, and he likely did so as a member of the Men's Political Union for Women's Enfranchisement. Now, the Men's Political Union was in effect the male wing of the WSPU, which increasingly I wouldn't say rejected, but preferred men's involvement to be indirect, not being direct members of the WSPU itself. The Men's Political Union was set up by Victor Duval, and it was one of two key organisations set up for men by men in this period, wishing to support women's claims for the vote, the other being the law-abiding Men's League for Women's Suffrage. Now, for breaking Home Office windows, William was sentenced to 2 months hard labour. And this was an extraordinarily hard punishment for someone that had never been in trouble with the law and was testified to have been of good character. Now, when in prison, William declined to take prison food unless he could order his own. Now, this was a courtesy that was extended to political prisoners, okay, in the first class division, a courtesy that should have been extended to suffragettes, but of course it wasn't, because the government classified suffragettes, whether male or female, not as political prisoners, but as criminals, and therefore as third class prisoners, where treatment was much harsher. Now, this was something that imprisoned suffragettes had protested against right from the very beginning, chiefly through hunger striking, which was now what William was really proposing to do. Now, just before I move on to William's case, it's worth noting that the option of ordering his own food had been offered to fellow Men's Political Union member Hugh Franklin. Now, the difference between William and Hugh, of course, is that Hugh was from a middle-class and very well-connected political family. William wasn't. Now, the different treatment of suffragette prisoners based on class was something that had already been highlighted by suffragettes, most famously through the case of Lady Constance Lytton. Now, Lady Constance Lytton was arrested as herself, sort of went through the same motivations of protesting against not being categorised as a political prisoner. However, she had a thorough medical examination and it was deemed that she wasn't suitable for prison, she wasn't suitable for hunger striking or forced feeding because she was found to have a heart murmur. So she was very quickly released. Now, Constance was highly suspicious that her treatment had been lenient because of her high social status, because she was Lady Constance Lytton. And so, incredibly bravely, she got herself rearrested, not this time as Lady Constance Lytton, but as working-class woman Jane Wharton. She disguised herself. As Jane, when she was rearrested, she received no such thorough medical examination, so of course no heart murmur was found, and having refused food, she was brutally force-fed on numerous occasions. Now, I'm sure you will have heard of force feeding. I'm sure you probably know what it's all about, but just in case, I think it's worth talking about it. Sorry, firstly, of course, there is Lady Constance Lytton and Lady Constance Lytton disguised as Jane Wharton, under which guise she got herself rearrested and was completely treated differently. So forcible feeding in prison, a horrible, brutal practice. The prisoner was held down and a tube inserted into either their nose or throat. And there is at least one case where we suspect, and there's certainly evidence to suggest, that this may have even been carried out on at least one suffragette anally. The tubes, which were generally unsanitised, often ended up being forced into the lungs by mistake instead of into the stomach. And so you can imagine that this liquid food was forced into the lungs instead of the stomach, causing chest infections, causing pneumonia, causing all sorts of complications. And there are also recorded cases of women's teeth actually being chipped and broken, where if they resisted, a sort of vice-like metal implement would be put in their mouths and that would be cranked open to force their jaws apart. And it's worth mentioning, actually, that, you know, Constance Lytton, or a.k.a. Jane Wharton, never really recovered from this treatment that she received in prison. She had a mini-stroke quite shortly after, and by 1911 she had another more devastating stroke from which she never really recovered. Now, by refusing food as a working man, William Ball was also subject to this brutal practice. He was forcibly stripped by prison warders and then forcibly fed quite unimaginably twice a day for over 5.5 weeks. Now, his wife Jessie at this time was not allowed to see him, but she heard about his treatment and wrote several letters to the governor at Pentonville Prison inquiring after his health, but she was just ignored. There was no reply. Now, given that the 5 children that they had together were entirely dependent not just on William's wages, but also on Jessie's, she had to think of something. What was she going to do? So she wrote to the prison authorities to see if she could take out some life insurance on William, because she'd heard so many terrible things. And again, although this was something that could be done, she was curtly refused. I mean, I can't imagine how desperate she must have felt to have even had to go down that route. It just shows, you know, I mean, it's just terrible to even think about. Now, given that the prison authorities hadn't really communicated with Jessie, she did receive one communication from them. And it was very short, and it was very to the point. "Madam, I regret to inform you that it is intended to certify your husband insane, and an order will be made to detain him as a pauper lunatic." So William was very quickly discharged by the authorities into a mental asylum. Without any consultation with his own doctors or with his wife, he'd already been sent to Colney Hatch Lunatic Asylum by the time Jessie received the letter. And certainly before, you know, she got to prison, he wasn't there. He'd already been sent. So, of course, she rushed to his side to be there, to be with him. And she found him in a terrible condition. He was described as restless and talking wildly. He was emaciated. His nose and throat were ulcerated and horribly swollen, obviously from repeated forcible feedings. And he could barely talk. Now, thankfully, with the help and money provided by the WSPU and members of the Men's Political Union, as well as other well-wishers, William was eventually moved to a private nursing home where, with proper care and nourishment, thankfully, he made a full recovery. But his treatment, rightly, caused absolute outrage. You can see here the Women's Social and Political Union, you know, were sort of quite vocal in publicising his case. And members related to the Men's Political Union and Women's Social Political Union, many of whom were lawyers and had good connections, you know, set about launching a series of official complaints to the Home Office about his horrific treatment. And very reluctantly, because of that pressure, a formal inquiry was conducted. I'm guessing you won't be surprised to hear that that inquiry was completely biased and set out to exonerate the prison and the government from any responsibility for William's condition, despite evidence obviously strongly showing the contrary. Despite showing no prior signs of mental ill health and being very physically fit, the authorities stated that William's condition had nothing whatsoever to do with his treatment in prison. Instead, the report blamed William's condition on his own defective character, on his feeble intellect, and on the excitement of indulging in suffragette activities. And this was a tactic that was actually often used to try and belittle men who stood up for the women's suffrage cause. Now, unbelievably, and we see this so often with female suffragettes too, despite this ordeal, William was back in prison again, having carried out another suffragette protest in 1912. And I think this says something about his, as well as all of the other suffragettes' courage and strength of character to face that, having already been through such a terrible ordeal. I mean, it's absolute commitment beyond belief. And although William actually went on hunger strike again, this time he was released after just 2 days when his fine was paid anonymously, so we don't know who did that, but he was released after 2 days. And very, very little, at the moment at least, is known about William's life after these events. So, to conclude, I really just want to say that all of these case studies, all of the lives, all of the snapshots of these lives are recorded on the Historical Association's Suffrage Resources database. And there are also a myriad of other resources built around that database. And I really urge you, and if you could urge your friends and colleagues to use it, because it really is a fabulous resource. And the more we can reveal these hidden histories, the ordinary lives of people that dedicated and sacrificed so much for this campaign, I think the better, that they can get their deserved place and the recognition that they deserve. So please do visit the site. There are podcasts by suffrage experts, including Elizabeth Crawford and Jill Liddington. There's the database itself, which obviously I've talked about today. There are case studies of individuals with educational resources attached to them. There are articles as well from academics as well as educational scholars advising on perhaps different ways of approaching the Votes for Women campaign in the curriculum. So really, you know, do use it. If for nothing else, then for education and for the memory of some of the people that I've talked about today. Thank you.